He says, Omer Mutar Onusu. He's of the opinion that Omer Mutar, if a person says, I thought it was permissible, so he is, again, like an innocent bystander. Accidental, that's it. Alright. So naturally, Rabbi and Rav Chisda are not very happy with each other's opinions. So Rabbi asked the following question of Rav Chisda. He says, look, we read in the Torah just a couple of weeks ago about Abraham Avinu and Avimelech. Remember?
Mm-hmm.
This is, of course, the second incident. The first incident was where Abraham Avinu went to Mitzrayim. And there, you know, he realizes he has a beautiful wife. And the talk of the people of Egypt, you know, they praise Sarah's beauty to the king. And so Pharaoh took her into his house. And, you know, fortunately, the Rebbeinu Shalom took care that they should not be able to do anything to her. And then, of course, when he found out the deception, you know, so if you remember, he threw out Abraham. Okay. Item number two.
Throw him out exactly. He gave him a lot
of
kids.
Well, okay. Item number two was this time Abraham Avinu goes down to Melech Plishtim and Gror, right? And again, what does he do? He tells Sarah and so on and so forth, you know, that that she should not reveal, you know, that she's his wife, but instead that, you know, she's his sister, right? And then and there we read that the Rebbeinu Shel Olam came in a dream to Avimelech, right? Bachalom Alayla. And he said to him, what? This is what he said to him, quotation mark. Hincho meis al Yeshua asher lekachta, right? You deserve to die now. You're about to die. You deserve to die because of this woman that you have taken. So he says, my la bidei Adam. So maybe we mean that he should be put to death by a court of human beings, in other words, a court, you know, an earthly court, if you wish, right? He says, lo. He says, it's bidei shamayim. Rather, no, the punishment is to be by Rebbeinu Shel Olam, right? Literally, by the heavenly court, okay? They were to punish Avimelech, okay? And continued Rava in his questioning about this, he says, Daikanami, look, he says, take a look very carefully at the Pasuk, Dichsiv, where it's written just a little bit afterwards, you know, in the you know, in the same section over there, that the Rebbeinu Shel Olam says, Havi Melech, and therefore I spared you mechatoli, from sinning unto me. Now, from sinning unto me means that the Rebbeinu Shel Olam says, you know, I'm the one who should punish you because of what you did. So, this is what Rava said to Rav Chisda. Now along comes Rav Chisda, and he says, well, if this is the way you're reasoning, then how about the pasuk, you know, this time we're talking about Yosef, who is being tempted by whom?
A queen.
Yeah, well, she wasn't a queen, but she was married to a big shot, right? Potiphar's wife, okay? Potiphar's wife, Ashes Potiphar. And, you know, she tries to get him into bed, and he refuses, as if you remember. And he says to her, you know, that God forbid that I should do anything like this, because if I do anything like this, then v'chotosi l'Elohim, I will have sinned unto God, right? And so, tell me, he says, do you mean l'Elohim? It's a sin unto God, but l'Elo Adam, not to man. After all, adultery is a sin to be punished not just by God, but it's a sin to be punished by
man.
by the courts. Of course, today we see that the princes and princesses
talk about those.
Tell openly about their affairs, and obviously the B'nai Adam, the courts, you know, B'nai Adam, it's not being enforced. I think back, you know, to King Henry VIII.
You know,
when he even had a suspicion,
you remember that?
Or it was a made-up conspiracy, right? That he chopped off the head. I mean, poor Anne Boleyn, if you remember, right?
Look at the psychological punishment.
Right.
You're going
Yes.
According to psychological
question. Right.
That's also a
question. So he says.
But adultery is not is not a civil sin anymore, is it?
Well, the way it's glorified. And
I mean, you can't. If you,
yeah, I understand what you're saying. Right.
It can be grounds for divorce, but it can't be. You can't put a man in jail for committing adultery.
It used to be, you know, on the statute books that you could put a person into jail for committing adultery.
Yeah.
But it's not enforced. Even if it's still on the books, it's not enforced. But in many states, I guess they probably simply removed it again as being a criminal
offense.
So
to me, in my mind, the laws are only issues that society regards them.
Yeah.
And sooner or later, they change it. In other words, the simplicity of it is if the speed limit out here is 35 miles an hour,
right,
but everybody does 50,
yeah,
everybody's ignoring it.
Yeah.
And now adultery, society is it's on the book, but the society has moved. So a illegitimate pregnancy or whatever.
Right, well, that's true. Yeah.
And now society, what depends? It may circle around as society will frown on it, but right now it's
what. Yeah, right.
In other words, society is going to do it. Regardless of the law.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Laws are only made for the benefit of society.
Yeah. But of course, you know,
but there you have to have
from our point of view, however, as Jews, we do have certain standards that we go by.
Absolutely.
That, you know, even if it may not be any more the conventional thing, but nevertheless, it's still something that we're expected to adhere to.
Yes. Well, our Torah
won't
ever deviate.
Right, right. I mean, if we believe, you know, that this is the Torah says, you should not commit adultery, then that means that's a great sin.
These are our laws.
Right.
I mean, I'm talking about civil law.
The fact that actually the Torah also has a death penalty for the noe, for the noephis, in other words, the man and the woman who are caught in the act of adultery. But that already, as we learned, they have to be warned, that they have to be caught in the act and everything else. And so
we're studying right now this section of the interesting how the Judaism will regard if a rabbi taught this boy to kill Rabin, the punishment for the rabbi. And this is what we're studying, in effect.
Yeah, I mean, the question is whether the rabbi could be considered, let's say, like an accessory or something like that.
But they definitely bring in the word of a witness or witnesses here.
Yeah. Okay, so we continue.
Yeah.
So, just as we say that, you know, adultery then in the case of Joseph, if he, Chas v'Shalom, had committed it, he would not only be sinning unto God, right? Not to man. Elodino Mosul Adam, right? His judgment also would be handed over, in other words, to a human court in order to judge him for committing adultery. So, Hochonami. So, in the case, likewise, of getting back to Avimelech, right? If he, you know, he too then not only should have been punished by God, you know, that he sinned unto God by taking Sarah, even though he was not aware of the fact that she was Abraham's wife until the Rabbeinu Shel Olam said that unto him. So, nevertheless, the court should have punished him also for that. So, Eis v'Abaye l'Rava. So now Abaye gets back at Rava. He says, look, when Avimelech pleaded with the Rabbeinu Shel Olam, he said to him, Rabbeinu Shel Olam, he says, Hagoy gam tzadik daharoig, will you also slay literally a people that is tzadik, in other words, that's absolutely innocent, did not have any hand in this? And of course the implication is, look, I'm a goy and I'm a tzadik, so you're going to punish me? I didn't know. Absolutely, I was absolutely innocent in this matter, right? So he says, Hosom Dikaho Mahadre Aluye. So, in that particular case, we have to go back to how did the Rabbeinu Shel Olam answer this question on the part of Avimelech? You know, he said, look, I'm a tzaddik, my people are tzaddikim, why do they want to punish me? So what did the Rabbeinu Shel Olam say unto him? He said unto him, "V'yato Hoshev Eishes Hoyish Kinovihu. And now he says, return the wife of this man because he is a prophet. Okay? In other words, he did wrong. But you can write it how? By returning this man's wife because he's a prophet. So immediately the Gemara says, what do you mean? It says, Eishes Novihu? You say, oh, there. Does that pasuk mean that because she is the wife of a prophet, that's why she should be restored to her husband? The last Nabi, Lo Sehodor, are you going to tell me that even if she was not married to a Nabi, she should not be returned to her husband? Obviously, that's not it. So, Ela de Koma Rav Shmuel Banachmin. So, rather, we have to come to an interpretation given by Rav Shmuel Banachmin. Doma Rav Shmuel Banachmin, Yoma Rav Yonason, who said in the name of Rav Yonason, he says, Hochi ka omale. This is what the Rabbeinu Shel Olam said unto Abimelech. He said to him, V'yato hoshev eishes ha'ish, right? Return now this eishes ha'ish, this woman who is married to a man, mikol mokom, and it wouldn't make any difference what kind of a man he is, whether he's a prophet or he's not a prophet. Ah, v'deka amre t'hagoy gam sadik t'haroig. And as far as what you're saying, Rebbeinu Shel Olam, you're going to punish a people that's absolutely innocent, that's righteous? Halo hu amali achosihi, after all, didn't he say unto me that she is my sister?
Mm-hmm.
He says, you know what, Avimelech, he says, Novihu, this is now where the Novihu comes, right? He is a prophet. Omim cholomad. And not only that, he learned from you what the problem was associated. Namely, Achsenai hu shebolair aliske achiloshisir sheyalin, I say. Right? If a person goes and he travels and he comes to another city and he needs lodging. So, what kind of questions do they ask? They ask questions. Where would you like to eat? Where would you like to drink? Right? This is the kind of questions that they ask you. Klum shu'alim oso ishtechozu achoschozu. Do they ask, tell me, is she your sister? Is she your wife? That's the kind of a question you ask a man who has a woman accompanying him. Nikan. So from this we derive the fact sheben noyach neherag, that a Ben Noach can be put to death for whatever it may be. Why? For the simple reason that he should have understood, he should have learned, he should have known what was right and what was wrong. And as a Ben Noach, he not only is commanded not to kill, but also another thing that a Ben Noach is commanded in is not to commit adultery. And so he should know that this is it, and therefore he deserves the death penalty. Aye, the fact that we're not inflicting a death penalty, that's already a different story. But the fact is, from a theoretical point of view, he says he should have known. So likewise, getting back again to what started this discussion about the Ger Toshav, we said before, that if he killed another Ger Toshav inadvertently, then he goes into Golus. But if he killed a Yisrael inadvertently, then he has to be put to death? No. When it comes to halacha, we don't apply that particular thing. Because even though, we can argue from theory that Ben Noach Neharag, that for any infraction of these basic rules, the Ben Noach deserves the death penalty, even without, as we said, hasra, right? Even without prior warning, because he is expected, to learn these fundamental rules. This is not complicated, like, for example, knowing, are you, violating Shabbos or something like that, where there are many, many different laws, and, the laws of Shabbos are complete, and the Talmud, that like mountains, there's a whole pile of them, you see. So that's really difficult. But basic things, not to murder, not to steal, right? Of course, not to commit adultery. to set up a court of law so that you know you don't have to judge by. I mean, these are things which are basic to any society, and therefore these are ideas that you should have learned. So that therefore, even if in theory it's Nehrag, all right, we're not going to apply it, but theoretically it could happen. That's all.
So
yeah.
Sum it all up.
Where is the authority for that?
They figure it out in the Gemara and Sanhedrin. That he does not, he should theoretically get the death penalty because he should have learned. Look, a Jew also is supposed to learn the law. We have come across again, we had it already before, that a chaver, person who is learned in the law, he doesn't require hasra. Does not require. If he commits, something, a murder or whatever it may be, he doesn't require hasra. Why? Because, as the general theory is, hasra was there in order to lahatchin ben shegeg lemezik, in order that we know the difference and make a distinction between a person who does things in error, not because of maliciousness or anything like that, that happened and that's it, and he didn't know, he didn't realize that, it was wrong, as compared to a mazin, who does things deliberately, purposely. So the same thing would apply. All right. Now we continue with the new Mishnah and the new Gemara. Mishnah now continues. It says that Hasuma Eino Gole, Divrei Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Gole. A blind person does not go into Golas. This is the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda. Whereas Rabbi Meir says he does go into Golas. Naturally, we're talking about a blind person who inadvertently killed somebody. Okay? So there's a difference of opinions we see between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Meir. What is this difference of opinion based on? This we'll see when we study the Gemara that follows. Okay? Hasone, if a person hates another person, in other words, he's an enemy of the person whom he killed inadvertently, again, we're talking only inadvertently, right? Killed somebody inadvertently, but he's known to be an enemy of this person. He hates him, he doesn't talk to him, he won't have anything to do with him, and so on and so forth. So, what's the story over there? So, Rabbi Yossi Yomer, Rabbi Yossi says, Hasone Neherag, Ibneshu Kibuad, that the Sone should be put to death. Why? Because he is as if he were Muad. Now, going back again, what is Muad? This we had several times. Muad means, that it's as if we already know him to be a dangerous person. Remember, we had, for example, a Shor Tam and a Shor Muad. Shor Tam is one, an animal that kills for the first time, okay, even if it kills for the second time. But if we see already that this kind of an animal, he likes to kill others time and again, then we say that he's Muad. Okay. And then we have a principle in Gemara that says, Adam Muad Li'olam, that a human being is always considered as having been forewarned that he's not allowed to know to do this or that, then he deserves punishment. Okay? Case of an animal, there's a difference between what we call chatzi nezek, where he pays only half the amount of damage that he caused, as compared to nezek sholem, playing for the complete damages. But adam muad le'olam, if a person hurts you, then I'm not even talking about killing, I'm talking about hurting. Gives you a good clap so that you're hospitalized. Or, let's say he threw something inadvertently at the same time he hit you. So, alright? Whatever it may be. He's a human being. He did it. Then in that case, take him to the court and sue him for whatever it is that you have coming to you. You caused them to lose days of work, sue him for that. Right. Well, but even an inadvertent, I don't have to tell you, look, not in every case. I have the habit that I don't go suing people, but a lot of people, they'll sue you at the drop of a hat. All you have to do is listen to all the commercials, you know. Have an accident, call this guy, right? Yeah. Alan Sosinski.
Yeah.
Alan Goodman, and so on, I guess.
Salomon.
Right. Salomon. Boom.
I like that. No. What you're saying is that the, well, that's what economists dump.
Yeah.
They're supposed to say they don't have any capacity, whereas you're saying men.
Right.
Considered as
of course, because a person is an intelligent human being, presumably has the opportunity to learn what's right and what's wrong. So that, therefore, it's his job to try to avoid doing what's wrong. Okay? So, okay. So Rabbi Yossi says, Hasoni Neherag, right? The person who hates another one, and he inadvertently causes his death, he should be Nerak. He should be put to death because Neshu Kimuot. It's as though, you know, we feel that he has so much spite in him that he's only looking for an opportunity in order to do something to hurt him. You understand? That's how they mean Muad over here. Rabbi Shimon Omer, but Rabbi Shimon says, no, not Nid. He says, Yesh Sone Gola, the Yesh Sone Sheno Gola. There is an enemy who still has the privilege of going into Golos, and then there's also a Sone who doesn't go into Golos. And Zehak Lol, and this is the general rule, he says, Kol Shu Yochel Omar Ladas Horag Eino Gola. If a person says, or we can say concerning this person, okay, that he did it purposely, then ain't no gola. Then he does not go, you know, when he killed somebody inadvertently, but nevertheless, the circumstances were such that, you know, it was almost inevitable that he would kill the person whom he hated. So ain't no gola, he doesn't go into golas. Why? Because he didn't actually commit murder, but nevertheless, the circumstances were such that, you know, it happened. So, what happens? Yes?
First of all, we're talking a blind person. Okay. And you're not talking now an inadvertent.
Right, we're not talking about the blind person now. The Mishnah starts with the case of a blind person, but then it goes on to other circumstances.
Okay.
Besides the blind person, then the next person that it considers is the Sone.
Okay, the Sone, we're talking about the Sone engaging in an inadvertent killing? Or
yeah, naturally. But...
But it's one where he's said to have knowledge of the killing. That almost sounds like premeditation.
This is what they figure, that it's almost premeditated, even though it happened accidentally. But he created circumstances that made it almost inevitable for the death to take place. So that therefore he doesn't get golus for the reasons that we've already stated many times. He doesn't deserve the kapora, lo sagade the kapora, right? And the same thing with the goel hadam.
That's
right. Yeah, very reckless. Reckless and dangerous. Good, all right. But the shelolo das, if we see that even though he was an enemy, but nevertheless the circumstances are such that you can see that he did not, you know, do that, the present situation wherein he killed somebody was not as a result of deliberate circumstances, so Harei Segola, then he's entitled to Golas the same as anybody else. So who killed inadvertently? Tana Rabbana. So first they want to explain the business about why is the Summa either he goes into Golas or he doesn't go into Golas. Because remember, it's a difference of opinion between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Meir. So he says, Pasuk in the Torah says, Belo Re'os. But, you know, remember, this is where the Yapela lo Belo Re'os, okay, that he dropped something on top of the person whom he killed without seeing, you know, that the other person was there. Literally, this is what the circumstance is. All right. So he says, below Rahos, without seeing, so he says, Prot Lasuma. This, therefore, excludes a blind person, Divi Rabbi Yehuda. In other words, Rabbi Yehuda says that, you know, Eino Gola, he doesn't go in. He had no way to control the circumstances over here, and so therefore he does not go into Golos. Rabbi Meir Omer below Ra'os, he says the Pasuk without seeing is Lerabos is Asuma. This is in order to include even the blind person who also cannot see what is going on over there, and so he goes into Golos. So my Tam and the Rabbi Yehuda, what is Rabbi Yehuda's reason? Dichsiv, Pasuk says Vasher Yavos Vayehu Bayar, right? Whoever goes together with his fellow man into the forest. So I feel assume this would also include even a blind person going in there. So also below Ra'os. So along came below Ra'os, the Pasuk says, right? It says Lashavos Bayar, right? And then Bayapel Allah below Ra'os. This is what the Pasuk says. So why does then the Pasuk add, according to Rabbi Yehuda, below Ra'os? The answer is Miyate. These two words, they are there to exclude. What do they exclude? The answer is they exclude the blind person from having to go into Golos. Okay? The Rabbi Meir, as far as Rabbi Meir is concerned, he reads it differently. He says, below Ra'os, yeah, it's the Ma'at, no question about that. That's in order to exclude. So we think, aha, okay. So in other words, he should be free from Golos. But he says, look, we have another exclusionary phrase over there, namely Bibli Das. You understand? In other words, without any premeditation, literally, without knowledge, but it means without premeditation, all right? Lamai, that too is an exclusionary phrase. And now we have a Gemara, a principle in the Gemara that says, have a miyut, achar miyut. You have first an exclusionary phrase, and then another exclusionary phrase after it. The yain miyut, achar miyut, ila l'rabos. And the principle is that if you have one miyut after another, then in that case, the second time around actually includes, not excludes. Okay? So if that's the case, according to Rabbi Meir, then it means that I have to therefore include the blind person among those who will go into Golos. Okay? The Rabbi Yehuda. Alright? So how about him after all? He would also accept the idea of Miyut Achar Miyut, right? So how can he derive his business, that he goes, he's potter, doesn't go into Golos? So he says, but he does, this is problem is coming. That excludes the person who has the intention of killing. He intends to kill. So that therefore, problem is coming, Hudasa, right? This is the reason for that. It comes in order to tell us that. But if there is no premeditation, then in that case, how many miyutim do we have? We only have the miyut of below Ra'os. Below Ra'os means that he does not go into Golos. Okay. Do you follow what I said?
Well,
yes.
This ein miyut, achar miyut.
Yeah.
Do we read that in Rabbi Yishmael every morning?
No.
No, this is a different principle. Okay.
No, this is a principle that you find in various places in the Talmud, right? That first they say, okay, it's a miyut, this excludes. Then the next time around, no, wait a minute. Then if we have a third one, then in that case again it's a miyut, you understand? In other words, minus, plus, and that's the way it works. Depending upon how many you wind up with. Alright, now getting back to the business of the next part of the Mishnah, namely what? The Sonei. That Rabbi Yosef Omer HaSonei Neherag, right, he says that if a person hates one, then he deserves the death penalty if he, kills him inadvertently. And of course, needless to say, this is not the opinion as Rabbi Shimon comes up and he says, yes and no, it all depends, okay? So, first they ask the Kasha about Rabbi Shiyosi. How can you say that he should be Neharag, that he deserves to be put to death? The Holo Yisrube, says the Gemara. Look, they didn't even give him any warning. And of course, what did we learn? That if he doesn't have warning, then in that particular case, he's not a murderer, right? So they say, Masnisin Rabbi Yossi Bar Yehuda, he says that the Mishnah is really the opinion of Rabbi Yossi Bar Yehuda. The Tanya is, we've learned that Rabbi Yossi Bar Yehuda, Eimer, he says, Chober Eino Tzorach Hasron. That's what I mentioned before. Even though it's, you know, it's not just over here that we find it in other places too. That somebody who is a Torah scholar, he does not require Hasron. Because the whole principle of Hasra is in order that we may be able to distinguish between deliberate and error. Okay? Rabbi Shimon Oimer, he says, Yesh Senegel, Yesh Senegel, right? So he says, Tanya, Ketzad Omar Rabbi Shimon, how is it that Rabbi Shimon said, Yesh Senegel, Yesh Senegel, right? That there is an enemy who goes into colors and one that doesn't go into colors. So he gives an example. It says, Nifsak Goyle, Nishmat Eino Goyle. Nifsak, this we had before, where let's say he is lowering a rope, right? Lowering something with a rope, and then what happens? The rope suddenly snaps. So in that case, we learned that he goes into Golas, according to this opinion, right? Whereas Nishmat, if something, let's say, was dropped accidentally, then he doesn't go into Golas. So they say, Tanya, didn't we learn that Rabbi Shimon Oimer, Le'yelam eino yele ad she'yishomi bechamach tzole miyodayim? Didn't we learn that it never will go into Golas unless we have a situation where the iron of the trowel, whatever it is. All right, the trowel, Matsoli, this is in the case of the guy up on the roof, if you remember.
Yeah.
Okay, he was fixing the roof over there, and then the trowel upon which he was working, it slipped from his hand and it killed somebody down below, right? So they say, Kasha Nifsak on Nifsak and Kasha Nishmat as Nishmat. So it's a Kasha. Nifsak, does one opinion of Nifsak doesn't agree with another one concerning Nifsak, and likewise, Nishmat doesn't agree with Nishmat. Nifsak on Nifsak, Le Kasha. So they say, no, it's not a Kasha. Why? Ho Biyoyhev, Ho Bisayne. If a person is friendly with another person and the rope broke, then in that particular case, we would say what? That, it was an accident and he doesn't go into Golis. But if he was a Sine, then we might feel that, maybe he was negligent to use the wrong kind of a rope. I mean, he didn't bother to examine the strands to see whether they were strong enough. And so, therefore, he doesn't deserve to go into Golis. Okay? And how about Nishmat HaNishmat? In other words, if it slipped and fell, so it's no kash. He says, Ho Rabbi, Ho Rabbonin. It's a difference of opinion between Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi and the sages. Namely, alright, so here we have to rely upon the Rashi over here. Okay? And with that we shall. Okay? Alright. Nifsak. Okay, if you take a look, it's roughly about 8-9 lines. Okay, from the top. It says, Nifsak achevel, if the rope was, it snapped, v'nofal olov, and, it fell upon him, so ein lomar boladase. So we cannot say that he did this deliberately. Okay? Nishmat achevel miyodo, what if the rope fell from him? Rashi here is not talking about the trowel, but he says, let's say that the rope simply slipped from his hand, right? Benopla olov, and it fell upon him, eino gola. Then in that case, he does not deserve to go into gola. Sheyesh lomar, because we can say that asos, he did it deliberately, right? Then there's an opinion that says, loyel meino gola, that is never going to go into gola, loy heveloy seine, benifsak, in the case of, where the rope broke, because we would say the rope broke because it was an accident, Elabim Nishmat, but only in the case of Nishmat, in other words, where he let it slip from his hand, where we might say that maybe there was a deliberate attempt on his part. Okay? Machatzolo, what is the Machatzolo? He says, Huma Gela. He says that this is not the way you translated trowel. I know where you got the translation from. From here, right. But he says it's a Magela. The Magela, if you remember, we learned, is either a heavy stone that they used in order to smooth, let's say, the tar on the roof, or it was a roller that they used in order to plaster it. You know, actually, they used plaster, they didn't use tar, but they used plaster, okay? Right? All right? Because at times when they build, so he says when they plaster, they sometimes use a tool that is used by builders. And Balaz, twala. Here you have the word trowel over here in French. Okay? So, okay. So this is the reason why he has a translation trowel over here. Okay. All right. So Hochi Gassin. Now, Rashi is not happy with the text that we have over here, and so he's going to make a correction in the text. He says, Hochi Gassin, he says, Nishmat Anishmat Likasha, right? He says, where it slipped, this is not a kasha. Hobe Ehepo Besoine. Nifsak Anifsak Likasha, right? And in the case of Nifsak and Nifsak, you know, where the rope broke, this is also not a kasha because it represents the difference of opinion between Rabbi and Rabbona. So, Hodekotone Nishmat Goyle, where it is that we learn that if it slipped, he goes into Golis, this is in the case of an Oyev. If it was somebody, you know, who was friendly, that it happened. By the way, is there a man out there? No. Outside over here? Katoni Nishmat, he says, Goyle. Says, Beoyev. This is where a person is friendly, so in that case it was accidental, and he goes into Golis. Deloy Choshid, because he's not suspected, the Ovid Midas, that he did it, you know, that he let it slip deliberately. Ude Katoni Nishmat, and where we learn that Nishmat Eino Goyle, this is Besoyne, right? This is the case of somebody who is an enemy. The Katoni Behedya Bevraisa that we learn specifically in Bevraisa that Yishin Yishin Ugele, right? That there is one who doesn't. And Meforish Milsein explains that Nishmat Enugele, that, you know, if he let it slip, then he doesn't go to Golis, because as we said before, it looks, it's almost like being a deliberate action. Then he says, Nipsak on Nipsak, in the case of the rope that snapped, this is also Lokasha. He says, Ho Rabbi, Ho Rabbanim, because this is the difference of opinion between Rabbi Yehuda Nasi and the rabbis. Ho de Katoni Nifsa Goyle, that, you know, where the rope snapped and it goes into Golis, Safila Besoine, then even the Soine is entitled to go into Golis. The Kolch came in Ohev, and certainly all the more so in Ohev. Now, this represents the opinion of the Rabbanim. This is the rabbi's opinion. Va'aliba Rabbi Shimon, who the Omar Nishmat Habazel Nikato the Horag Goyle, who said that if the iron head, you know, fell out of the hammer, you know, that he was using, and it killed, then in that particular case, he goes into Golis. Benifsak hachevel, and here Rashi adds that if this rope snaps, it's dunya d'nishmat habarzel. This is similar to the case of where the hammer, you know, the iron slipped mikato from its handle. He shenisha ha'eged biyodo, because what he was grasping on is still in his hand. In other words, piece of rope or the wood, you know, the handle itself. The hodekotani nivsak enogele, and there where we learned that if it snapped, he doesn't go into exile. So Rabbi Yehuda's opinion, the Omar Nishmat HaBazel Bekato, that if the iron, you know, fell out of the, slipped out of the handle, Eino Gole doesn't, I mean, this is his opinion. The Huadin Lechevel HaNifsak, and he says the same rule applies also to a rope, you know, which snaps. Ad She Yishomet Machtzolo Miyodo. Unless the trowel, as we said before, should slip from his hand. She'ein nisha biyodei klum. Where in this case, nothing will be left in his hand. Dumyo demino eitza mispakeya. Which is similar to wood, which we said splintered off, right? Well, the rabbi, aliba de rabbi Shimon, ein lechotzeinu goyle. So, according to Rabbi Yehuda, if he follows the opinion of Rabbi Shimon, then we never have a case of a soine who goes into golas. This is what Rashi says. This is the reading that I found in Chuvas HaGoinim. V'chein Ikar. And he says, and this is how it should really read. All right, we'll stop at this particular point, and Mi'as Hashem will continue from the next Mishnah towards the bottom of page
so
Tess.
So we're now
Omid Beis. Below the middle line over there, there's another Mishnah.
Just start with the Mishnah.
Right,
the
Hechem
Golem.
Mishnah, yeah. Right, okay. So we'll start from there, Mitzvah Shem next week.
Could you go over Rashi's, which I don't quite understand the difference, why it makes a difference if somebody has a part of the rope or part of the trowel on his hand after it breaks?
Yeah. So the feeling is, right, all right, this is the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, okay, that avoid it. So you see, he's still holding on to that part, you know, which he thought was in good shape.
Right.
And unfortunately, it happened that either the rope snapped, or that the head of the axe, you know, the hammer, whatever it was used, you know, it slipped out of the handle.
Whereas you think there may be a suspicion of bad faith, especially
right,
dealing with
right,
if his hand is completely empty,
exactly,
yeah,
right. It's as though, you know, he deliberately let it fall down, even if he didn't, but you know, it would seem more like a deliberate act.
Okay.
So yes, Hashem, we shall continue. Okay, on your mark, set, go.
Where are we now?
We are still on Daf Tes Amud Beis. We're going to move on.
About how far down would it be?
Okay, you see what says Mufdisan over there? Right over there.
Right here.
Yeah, okay. This is where the Mishnah starts.
Yeah, okay.
Get your finger down one line. There we are.
Where it says Mishnah?
Okay, Lehechen
Golan. Okay.
Lehechen Golan. So the question that the Mishnah asks now is, and where do they go into exile? So the answer is Lore Miklot, to the cities of refuge. L'sholo Shebeva Hayaldein, L'sholo Shebeitz Kanan, the three cities that were set aside as cities of refuge on the other side of the Jordan, in other words, you know, to the east of the Jordan River, and three that are in the land of Canaan, which is, you know, all the area which is west of the Jordan River. Shenemar, as it is written, Eishalosh Ha'orim Titnu Me'eva La'yardein, three cities you shall set aside on the other side of the Jordan. And three cities you shall set aside in the land of Canaan. So, the Mishnah continues and says, Ad shelo nivcharu shalosh be'eretz Yisrael, lo hayu shalosh be'eva hayaden koltos. Until the three cities were set aside in Eretz Yisrael proper, in other words, you know, the area which is west of the Jordan, until those three cities were set aside, then the three cities that were already set aside on the other side of the Jordan, they could not take effect. They could not serve as cities of refuge until the other three were
all six had to be in operation
for them to be in operation.
Of course, the other side of the Jordan, would that be like where Amman is today?
Sure.
Not the same area.
Yeah, well, Amman is part of Ibn HaYadin. Right. Yeah. The only thing is, the other side of the Jordan really had different areas that you have to realize, okay? If we would consider it today, okay, then you actually had three different
areas.
Three different territories. One of them was Moab, that was more to the south, okay? Then you have Ammon, which was roughly, that would be opposite, you know, let's say, you like, if you were to go east of Yerushalayim to the Dead Sea, and so that would be Ammon. And then you go north of that, then you have the area which was called Gilad. That already was Jewish territory.
Yeah.
You had Gilad, Bashan, Golan. Okay. This was all Jewish territory. Okay?
Golan is the Golan Heights?
Golan, sure, absolutely. And that was incidentally set aside as one of the areas of refuge. There was a city in those days also called Golan, besides, you know, calling the whole thing the Golan, okay? But that's all Jewish territory. That the Syrians wanted in those days. No,
it wasn't Jewish.
Well, there were times, I mean, when under King David, for example, he conquered some of those areas, okay?
So under his...
But, you know, subsequently, other kings lost the territory, you see. So, this is what the history was. But anything that was north of Ammon, automatically, that was Jewish territory, no question about that. And that was settled, you know, by the B'nai Reuven, right?
Yeah.
B'nai Gad. They settled that area, and also part of the tribe of Menashe, Asi Sheikh Menashe. These were tribes, you know, that lived on the other side of the Jordan and lived to the east of the Jordan. Okay. All right. So now, getting back over here to our text, you remember, and we'll come across it tonight, the three cities that were set aside in Eber HaYarden, they were set aside by Moshe Rabbeinu. Yes. Oz Yavdil Moshe Shol Hashem Be'eva Yadim Mizchor Shemesh. It says Alu Shem Kavur Tzeach Hashayinu Shem Hashayinu Hashay Yitzach Nefesh Bishgoga, etc., etc., and so on. And then it names them as Betz Ba'Midbar, as Golan Ba'Boshon, and so on. Okay. So we'll find out. They're going to be named again afterwards. Okay. But they were already named by Moshe Rabbeinu. However, the point is that even though he named those three cities, nevertheless, they could not accept Rotschim, you know, they couldn't accept the people who had killed. Manslaughters, if you wish, but as we'll see, there's an opinion mentioned that, as a matter of fact, anybody who committed murder was, first of all, escorted to these places. We'll see that tonight, okay?
One thought with me about this, how are these people protected from the blood relatives of the people who the person who was killed and coming into the cities of refuge and taking revenge? How were they protected?
We'll see in a minute that they had to be accompanied by two Talmidei Chachamim from the place where the death occurred until they reached the city of refuge, and then if they had to be tried again, so they were escorted again back again, and so on.
But once they're there, let's assume they were found to be innocent.
Once they were in the city, then this was like out of bounds for the Goel Hadam. If he would step outside the city, then bingo.
In other words, nobody was allowed in the city who was not an accidental murderer?
No, because as we'll see, they also had a population.
Oh.
We'll see that also. But the point is that, you know, they have a population in order to supply them with all the needs that they need for living. We'll see that in a few minutes, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was the job of the Talmidei Chachamim who escorted him to, A, speak to the Goel Hadam, and tell him, you know, that he's not allowed to murder, and even to say, look, if you kill him in the when he's under our protection, then in that particular case, you yourself will be condemned to death as a murderer and so on. This is how it worked.
I see.
But if he went out on his own, then in that case, the protection
ceased. It's an open game, yeah.
Right, exactly. All right. Okay. So, the Mishnah continues, after saying, you know, that the three that are at Nevar HaYarden cannot provide the shelter, you know, for the manslayers until the three were also set aside in Eretz Yisrael, right? Shenemar Shesh Ori Miklot Tiena, right, that there have to be six cities of refuge. Ashiyu Sheshton Kol Toskiachas, until all six will be able to function as shelters together. Umechuvanos lehem drachim mizu lezu, which means in this particular case that roads were set aside, you know, direct roads for them from one city of refuge to another. Shenemar, as it is written, tochim l'chol haderech v'shilashta. It's written, first of all, you shall prepare for yourself the road. In other words, so you have to make a highway which, as we'll see, they're going to have road signs to say, Miklot. There is Israel, by the way. All houses, ever since, you know, the wars and everything else, they have to have a shelter. So, what is the word for the shelter? The answer is Miklot.
Miklot.
Right, so,
refuge.
Yeah, I remember when my daughter moved into Ramot Polin at that time. Before the first shul was built, and they started to build other shuls, so they had a load of them, shuls and shivas, etc., etc. But at that time, where did we used to daven? We used to daven down in the Miklot.
In the refuge.
Yeah, right. This was the shelter, you know. The
bomb shelter.
Bomb shelter, right. This is where we set up a little room, and then we davened over there.
Yeah, let's save it over there.
Sure. So,
okay.
You still see the word Miklot in Eretz Yisrael.
Okay.
But as I say, we'll learn that they put up signposts on the way to say Miklot. Right? And the Shilashto means that, and you shall also divide them into three. In other words, we'll see that Eretz Yisrael was divided into three areas on one side of the Jordan and into three areas on the other side of the Jordan. And here's where the Mishnah continues and says, "Amosan hen shnei talmidei chachomim," right? And they would hand over, that is, the court would appoint for them two talmidei chachomim, who, of course, his job was to escort them, "Shemo yahagenu baderech," lest the goel adam should kill the manslayer while he was on the road, you know, to get to the Ir HaMiklot. The yadabru elav, and they are to speak to him. In other words, they are these talmidei chachamim are to talk to the goel hadam and to tell him that you know, first of all, he shouldn't take vengeance, and secondly, that you know, he would be liable for murder if he did it not according to the law of the Torah, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Rabbi Yosef bar Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Yosef bar Yehuda says, Rabbi Meir Omer, right, that afhu medaber zayatzbo. In other words, the murderer, that is, the manslayer himself, can talk to the goel hadam. He too, you know, can plead his case before him and say, please don't take vengeance because, you know, I didn't intend to kill him. Right, it was accidental. Shenemar, because the pasuk says, v'zeh devar ha-ratzeach. Because what it means, you know, is, and this is the matter of the murderer. In other words, this is what is supposed to happen in the case of, but if you take it literally, what does Devar mean? It means word. So that this is the word of the Rotzeach. In other words, the Rotzeach too can talk to him. Okay?
Complete his case.
Complete his case to the Goel Adam. Rabbi Yosi bar Yehuda Omer, he says, Batchila, to begin with, he says, Echad Shoigeg, the Echad Mezid, it made no difference whether a person had slain someone either inadvertently or deliberately. Magdimli Ori Miklot. First thing that they do is that they go to the Ori Miklot. Vezdin Sholchin Mavin Oisa Misham. And then the Bezdin would send messengers, of course, you know, emissaries, to bring him from there, in other words, to bring him, you know, from the Ir Miklot, to bring him to the Bezdin.
in that town.
Huh? Not necessarily in the town, no. Wherever the original murder had taken place. Okay? So, Mishan is Chayev Misa Bevezdin. Of course, I mean, the Bezdin didn't sit everywhere, you understand that. There were Bezdins, you know, in certain important towns is where they had a Bezdin. Okay? So, Mishan is Chayev Misa Bevezdin. Then, if a person deserved a death sentence, you know, at the according to the verdict of the Bezdin, then Harugu, then in that case they put him to death over there. Okay. That is, you know, where the Bezdin was. Remember we had learned, right, that, you know, the other Adam, in other words, the witnesses who had warned him not to do it, and he did it deliberately and everything else. So they were the first ones, you know, who had to take part in the execution. Okay. The Shalom is Chayav Misa, but if a person did not deserve the death penalty, right, then Pitoruhu, then they, the Bezdin would free him. That is, you know, if it were, as we've already said, let's say, pure accident, there was no negligence on his part. Accident. It was, as we had said before, let's say, Derech Aliyah, not Derech Yerida, and so on and so forth, you know. Yeah. In other words, it happened in a way that he could not have been held responsible because, you know, this was purely accidental. But then in that case, the Bezdin, they free him. But Mishan is Chayav Golus. But if the Bezdin determines that, you know, he has to pay the penalty of going into exile, then in that case, then they return him to his place, meaning to the place, to the city of refuge, from which they had taken him in order to judge him before the Bezdin. Okay? Shnemar, as the Pasuk says, Vaheshivu Oso, that the Edo, in other words, in this case, you know, like the court, literally means the congregation. Okay. But I'll get back to this in 1 second. Let me first translate it. Okay, that the court will have him return to the city of his refuge. All right, now why did I translate the word Edo as court? It's really a somewhat liberal translation. But if you go back to the Gemara, in Sanhedrin over there, where they speak about how many people do you have to have in order to form a Sanhedrin to judge a murderer, okay? So they come to the following conclusion, that you have to have 23. Why?
Why 23?
Why 23? Okay, so they say over there because you have... one pasuk in the Torah says, Lo siachre... you know, that you're not allowed, you know, it says that you can have an Eidor in order to condemn a person. And then it also says, that you have to have an Eidor in order to plead on behalf of the person, right? So that's already how many? 20, that's already 20. In other words, each Eidor is considered 10. Of course, how do you get the word that Eidor means at least 10 people? The answer is because, if you remember, when the spies came back from Eretz Yisrael, so they were divided. 10 spies said, you know, we can't do it. And of course, Yehoshua and Kalei ben Yefuna, they said, we can do it, right? So the Rabbeinu Shel Olam says, the Moshe Rabbeinu says, Ad Mosar lo Edo Hora Hazois. How long do I have to put up with this evil Edo? And actually, how many were there in the evil? It was 10. So this we know. This is why a congregation has to be 10. Not less than 10. You have to have 10 for a minion, okay? So, you have an Edom Matzelis, right? An Edom Mechayevis, in other words, 10. So, and if you have an even split between 10, you know, it's an even count, we have to have 3 more. Why? Because, right, you cannot have an even number to begin with, and you have to be able to break a tie. And also, they feel that inasmuch as we always try to work for the benefit of the person who is accused, we always give him the benefit of the doubt, so that therefore, if, for example, it says, you know, that there was a majority of one in order to free him, then he is free. But you cannot condemn a person to death if there's only a majority of one. So that therefore they have to have at least 2 who will be voting to condemn, if there is one, you know, who votes, you know, yeah, to save them.
One,
right? Yeah. So that this is how the Gemara works it out. Okay. So therefore, when it says over here, the Heshiva Hoso Edo, obviously we're talking about the fact that the court. Okay.
But then, that's why the 22 of the even again. So.
Right. Now, of course, I mean, there are those, you know, we say every Tuesday morning of the Kibnitzah Bar HaSeil Bekevetim Yishpot, okay? So, God stands literally in the assembly of the Lord, right? And in the midst of the judges, does he judge? So, you know, there are some who say that therefore you have to have, you know, an eight of judges. I mean, that should be 10. But in reality, Bekevetim Yishpot, we say that 3 judges are enough for the ordinary Bezdin.
Yeah.
All right. But at any rate, the basic idea of that verse in the Psalms is the fact that, you know, that where justice is in the spirit of Torah, then God is there too.
Where does that pasuk come from?
It's from Tillim. We say it every Tuesday morning.
Tuesday morning.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Is that for the Psalm of the day?
Yeah, it's the Psalm of the day, right?
Tuesday.
All right. Okay. We'll take a look at the Rashi for this Mishnah. Not until, you know, the 3 were set aside in the land of Canaan. It says, "Hainu kol arba esrei shekovshu v'chilku v'yachakein hibdilon Yehoshua." It says there were 14 years in which they fought a battle against the Canaanites in order to conquer the land and subsequently to divide the land. And then, after these things had taken place, then Joshua is the one who set aside the 3 cities of refuge.
14 years, you're talking about.
14 years. It wasn't an easy conquest. It didn't happen just overnight. It took time to conquer, and it took time also to divide the land to make sure that the various tribes weren't going into fighting over, you know, who's going to get this land, who's going to get that territory. So
they never really conquered all the land that was set aside for them.
Well, theoretically, they did. But in reality, there were always little pockets left. So the 3 cities that Moshe himself had set aside in the Eval Yarden, you know, they were not able to serve as cities of refuge. The Adabru Elov, all right? We said that to talk to him, so it says to whom? It says El Goel Hadar, right? To the Lord Avenger. The Yomrim Lo, and they say to him, Al Tin Hag Bo Min Hag Shovchei Domim. Right? Do not act towards him the way murderers act.
Spilling your blood.
Yeah. Bishgoga bo masaliyodo. In other words, this thing that happened, right, it happened accidentally. And batchilo, klomer, tchilas mishpot kol rotzchim. In other words, the beginning of the passing judgment on anyone who killed, va'afilu mizidin, even those who killed deliberately, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not just manslayers, as we would say, you know, people who are guilty of manslaughter, but even murderers, right? Was to begin that, you know, that they send them to the Ir Miklot, and then afterwards they decide what to do. The Yalatam and Bistifrod of Erav, Meva Orav Lo, Beno Salachas. They derived the fact from the Sifro, where it's written that the Pasuk says, Orav Lo, that he lay in wait for him. And then, right after that, we have a Dar Salachas, he's to flee to one of the cities. So, in other words, from this we see that even a murderer first went to the city of refuge before the Bezdin sent
him. Decided whether it was deliberate or accidental.
Right. Okay, Gemara. Tana Rabbanan says, Shalosh Orim Hivdil Moshe Be'Eva Hayardin, right? Moshe Rabbeinu set aside 3 cities in Eva Hayardin, Uchenegdon Hivdil Yehoshua Be'etz Kanan. Right, and parallel to them, if you wish, or connect on, right?
Against them.
That doesn't mean against. It means, and you know, and likewise. Or parallel to it is the way I'm translating
parallel
at the moment,
the word,
right?
That they use,
yeah. Right. So Joshua, he also uses parallel over there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So talking God, they were both on the same wavelength.
I think you wrote this.
Not quite. It's a good piece of work, by the way.
Yeah.
Okay. So Joshua set aside 3 cities in the land of Canaan. ומכוונס היו כמין שתי שורות שבקרן. He says, and the cities were arranged, in other words, they were sort of like parallel, even as you would have, let's say, two rows in a vineyard. Two rows of what? Well, it could be, let's say, two rows of vines that they ran parallel to each other, right?
One line was in Eretz Israel, and one line was in
Eber HaYarden, correct. And as we'll see, the cities were fairly parallel to each other. I mean, it may have, you know, been slightly off, but it was fairly parallel
to
each other.
That's been a good reason for it.
Yeah, right. Hebron b'Yehuda. So it says the city of Hebron in Yehuda is connected Betzer b'Midbar. You know, would be like on the same parallel as Betzer in the wilderness. Okay, which was of course in Eber HaYarden. Shechem, the Har Ephraim. Shechem, which is in the mountains of Ephraim, is connected Ramot b'Gilad. It's you know, it's like parallel to the city of Ramot in Gilad. Kedesh Bahar Naphtali, the city of Kedesh in the mountains of Naphtali, which would be in the north, is connected Golan by Bashan, right? It's to be parallel to Golan, which was in the land of Bashan. And Bashan is the northern part of what we would call, you know, today we call it the Golan Heights, but the Bashan was all that area over there that Syria covets. All right. Well, then
when did Syria get the Golan Heights? Was it a long time ago?
You know, the whole problem developed after the First World War. Yeah.
The British set it up.
Right. The British and the French made an agreement with each other to divvy up the land. So the French took Syria, and they took Lebanon. Right. That became their protectorate, okay? The British were given Eretz Israel as their protectorate, so to speak. And, you know, that included everything on the other side of the Jordan. Then, of course, in 1922, we find that Winston Churchill decided to take away Eber HaYarden from Palestine, as it was called in those days, and set up a kingdom for one of the British proteges, for the Hashemites. Why? They had helped the British, you know, with Allenby's army during the First World War.
Yeah.
And then they were supposed to be the rulers in Saudi Arabia. Yeah. So instead, Saud came along and he kicked them out. And, you know, he took over Arabia himself. So they felt that they had to do something for their protege, so that they gave him Eber HaYarden. And, you know, even if there were protests on the Jewish side, and there were, Sotnishka Holten. Actually, there were some Jewish settlements on the other side of the Jordan in those days.
There were some.
Oh, yeah, yeah, there were. But this is what happened over there, okay?
So
anyway, the Golan, you see, that is part of the deal. I guess Syria was given it by
France?
By France and England, even though it was really Jewish territory. I mean, it's really part of Eretz Israel, but, you know, they got it. Yeah. Matter of fact, I saw an article recently that wanted to prove that Golan was never considered as being part of anything else other than Eretz Israel. Yeah. So, but you know, the problem is that our friends, like Paris, and Paris naturally the State Department. But I'm talking even, you know, the leftists in Israel, that they don't care about the Jewish tradition or Jewish Bible or anything like that, unfortunately. They're more interested in making political deals, that's it. Yeah.
No politics.
Yeah. And then, of course, the pasuk says "Mishilashto," which means that you are to divide it into three. So he says "Shehu Mishulashin," that they are to be divided into three parts. "Sheyehei Midarom LeChevron," that from the southernmost border, let's say, to Chevron, should be about the same distance as "Kimechevron LeShchem," right? "Or Mechevron LeShchem," "Kimishchem LeKedesh," right? In other words, there should be about approximately one-third, 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 approximately. We'll see, actually, it doesn't quite work out that way, but still, that was the theory behind it, okay? And not only that, he says, but, yes, "Umishchem LeKedesh," right? Let's say, "Mishchem Kimishchem LeKedesh," right? "Umishchem LeKedesh," "Kimishchem LeKedesh LeTzafon." In other words, that the distance is to be roughly about the same distance as from Kedesh to the northern border. Be'Eber HaYarden, Telos, so that in Eber HaYarden you have three cities, right? And Be'eretz Yisrael, Telos. In Be'eretz Yisrael you have three. And as we said, they are to be considered, you know, like parallel to each other. All right. So far, so good. Now, Omar Abaye said, he wants to know why is it that Eber HaYarden actually has three cities of refuge, and Western Eretz Yisrael, if you wish, I mean anything west of the Jordan River, also has three. What is the problem? The problem is
it implies that they have more murderers.
Yeah, correct. In other words, if we go population-wise, naturally, the bulk of the Jewish population was Eretz Canaan, okay? Exactly. Whereas, in the, you know, the others, you know, the minority of the population was in Gilad, and yet they each have three cities of refuge.
Well, actually, it was only supposed to be two or two and a half tribes east of the Jordan, and the other
correct.
The rest of
two and a half tribes.
Nine and a half tribes were on the other side.
Correct.
So it was
right.
A great disparity.
Of course. So that's the thing that bothers him. So Omar Abaye says, but Gilad Shukhe writes him, says, you know why?
Okay.
Because in Gilad, in other words, east of the Jordan River, you have loads of murderers over there.
But that would mean murderers who were murdering accidentally. This would imply that the
not
more
necessarily, because didn't we say just a few moments ago that Tchila, right, that the beginning of the process, the first thing
they did was to have them all.
Whether it was manslaughter or murderers. So that being the case, then they really needed big Orei Miklot in order to absorb them. Okay?
So they're implying that there were a lot of murderers at that time?
This is the implication. It's based on the pasuk in Hosea, where Hosea happens to accuse the people of Gilad as being that kind of people. Yichsev, he says, as it is written. And this is the pasuk that he quotes. He says, Gilad, Kiryas Pa'alei Ovid. He says, Gilad is like a city of evildoers, right? Akubo Medam. Akubo means like with bloody footprints. This is what it is.
The word Akev,
the heel. In other words, you know, they make heel marks that are bloody over there. Mm-hmm. In other words, they're a bunch of murderers, he says. And you know, they say, my Akuba Midom, what does it mean, Akuba Midom? So, Omar Rabbi Loser, Shehoyu Oitvim Laharog Nefoshes. He says, the Pasuk implies that they were actually Oitvim in the sense of that they would lie in wait. Because you remember, Akov, the original idea, if you remember, it started with the business of Yankov Avinu, right? We read what was his hand doing? His Yodo Echezes Bakev Esau, right? He was grabbing, he was holding on to the heel of Esau when he was born. Okay. So from this we already have the general idea that La'akov means, you know, to follow after or to go after, to follow, you see. This is the way they use the word today. But as a matter of fact, if we take a look in Yirmiyahu, we find over there it has a pasuk Kichol Och or Kov Yaakov, which means everybody is trying to cheat the other person. In other words, the word akov he uses in the sense, you know, like to lie in wait in order to do harm to somebody. This is the way he understands the word, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So this is exactly the same interpretation that we're having over here. And Rashi says, you know, Okpin, if you take a look, the first line over there, it says, Orvin. In other words, they lie in wait. Good evening, Saul. How are you? It's good to see you. Hey, baby. Right, yeah. Trying to get out. Hey, good. You would have done better to go. But the trouble is, yeah, right, no matter where you got off.
Should have told the game, you got to go to
Saul. But you can still get off at Broad Street, can't you?
Yes. I told him, but they had still
there. He wouldn't know his way around.
Yeah,
probably.
Yeah. If you got north at the next exit at Broad Street
exit,
and come back, and then you could come back. But
if
you don't know the way, you bludgeon.
Especially at night.
Because you're going to have this on for since into January.
Yeah.
Nope.
Anyway,
we're on
again,
Ahmed Alif.
We're on Yud,
top
of the page. Right. So, Akuba Madam, he says, May Akuba Madam, what do we mean by that? So, Rabbi Lazar, I'll show you, Oikvin La Rog Nefoshes, that they actually would lie in wait in order to be able to kill people. So now.
They were premeditated murderers.
Right, no question about it. Yeah. So now they ask another question. The question is over here, Umayishno Mehai Gisa Mehai Gisa Dimrachke, Umayishno Mitzie Dimikarve, says, why do we have this difference that if we were to take a look at the map, we would see that in reality they were not completely divided, you know,
exactly
at, you know, one-third, you understand? What do we find? We find that in reality that on one side, the distance is long. And on the other one, namely where the middle cities of refuge were located, the distance is relatively short for, you know, a murderer, you know, to flee to a city of refuge.
Well,
so that's the question.
From
right.
Going from where to where?
Right.
Going from where to where?
Okay. We'll discover that what they're talking about is, okay, let's take a look at the Rashi, because Rashi explains. Okay. You see on the top line?
Yeah.
Says Mahai Gisa, Mahai Gisa Dimrachi. He says Hebron the Kedesh, Rechokos Mingvulei Horz. He says that both Hebron and Kedesh, remember Hebron was on in Eretz Israel, right? And Kedesh was in Eber Hayardim, right? These were the southernmost cities. So he says these southernmost cities were Rechokos Mingvulei Horz. They were rather far from the boundary line of the land. So in other words, let's say that a person had committed murder, or, you know, as we say, it was a manslayer, right? I mean, he did it, you know, accidentally, right? And he lived south of Hebron, okay? He could have a long distance in order to get, let's say, if he went down in a lot, right? To try to get to Hebron. That's a big distance, okay? So he wants to know then why, from this point of view, was the distance great, right? Whereas, you know, Shnei Rabbi Ha'oretz, right, that they were like two quarters of the land, in other words, about half the distance of Eretz Yisrael, just from one border, from the southernmost border to where Kedesh was located and where Hebron was located, right? So he says, "Vahoreg v'sof hagbul," right? And if a person killed somebody, and he was at the, you know, at the edge of the boundary, then sorek l'nisur v'yahors, he has to flee a quarter of the length of Eretz Yisrael in order to get to near Miklot. U'mayishna, and how about what's the difference? Why that mitziyoy? In other words, the middle ones, the Mikarvi, that they were closer together. He says, Ha'horeg ben Hebron and Shechem, right? If a person committed murder, or, you know, he killed somebody in the territory between Hebron and Shechem, or Uven Shechem the Kedesh, or between Shechem and Kedesh, then Korv the Miklat, Mikan Mikan, he's close to boundary, he's close to a city of, you know, of refuge, either side. So why this difference, right? So Omar Abaye, said the reason is that Bishchem Namesh Chichirotzim. We find that around Shechem also there were many murderers over there. Dichsev again, based on Hosea, who says Uchechake Ish Gedudim Chever Kahanim Derech Yiratzechu Shechem. All right, which means, and just as Gedudim, okay, lie in wait. Gedudim are bands, right? In this case, like bands of the robbers or murderers, whatever they are, right? Lie in wait for a man. Even like a chever kahanim, it doesn't mean that the kahanim are lying in wait for a man, you know, to kill him, but he means that, you know, apparently it was customary that when the harvest time came and they had to give out the you know, the various matnas kahunas, we would say, in other words, the matana, you know, the gifts that the Israelite has to give to the Kohen, so the Kohana would gang up together, you know, in order to make sure that they'll get their share.
Oh boy, they weren't murderers.
No, I didn't say, but Hosea compares the ganging up of Kohanim in order to receive their matanos to these guys who gang up in order to try to either rob or to kill a person. This is what he's making a comparison.
No, not from this translation.
What can I do?
He said, and the gangs awaited a man, a band of Kohanim murderers on the road to Shechem, etc. He says, yeah. Calls them Kohanim murderers.
But he explains it down further.
Okay. I hope that he excuses the Kohanim, because it's not really what he was referring to, right? But it says over there, Derech Yiratzechu Shchema, right? That the Derech Yiratzechu Shchema. They, on the road to Shchem, you know, they commit murder. Okay? So, and he explains, he says, My Chevah Kohanim, why this comparison to a group of Kohanim? So, Marvelosa Shohim is Chabrim Laharog, the Foshes Kohanim, Alolosham is Chabrim Lachalog Trumos, Beveis HaKodos, right? That, in other words, they would gang together in order to kill people, even like those Kohanim who gang together in order to receive their shares of trumos, you know, when the grain is brought to the threshing floor. Okay? So, this is the comparison. So, look, this is what the Gemara says. Okay, so let's not accuse the Kohanim of being murderers. Okay.
Well, they say these murderers would attack the victims as a group, so no one would know who delivered the death blow. And therefore, everybody escaped.
All right, that's not bad. Okay. All right, so they say the Su'ul Eka. Now, are we to assume that there are only six cities of refuge? That's it? The Lord said, don't we have a pasuk that says, it's the pasuk in Bamidbar, where it says, "Valehem titnu arboim shtayim ir," and to them you are to add 42 other cities. In other words, to make a total of how many? 48. Okay? So there were 48 cities that could possibly be cities of refuge. But there was a difference, as we'll see, between the six official and the other 42, which did not have exactly the same power. What was the difference?
They expected a lot of murderers.
Right. We only want to take sure. It's only Treffen.
It's only Treffen, right.
So Ma'abaye, he says, Halolu koltos ben ladas ben shalom ladas, and halolu ladas koltos shalom ladas in koltos. So Abaye says, these six official ones, they will provide refuge for a rotzeach, right? For somebody who has killed. And it makes no difference whether he's aware of the fact that he's in a city of refuge or whether he's not aware that he's in a city of refuge. But the others, the Das Koltos, if they went there expecting, you know, that they are going to find refuge over there, then they could find refuge. But Shalola Das Inan Koltos. But if they go there without realizing that this could be a place of refuge, then in that case it's not going to provide the refuge for them. This is how he explains it. Okay? Ben Ladas, let's take a look at the Rashi again. Okay? Ben Ladas, Ben Shalola Das, he says, Ben Sheborach Sham Ladas Klita, whether he escaped over there in order, you know, with the knowledge that, or with the expectation that he's going to find refuge there, or Bain, you know, Borach Shom, Shalom Ladas, right? Shalom Hoyodea Sheikales, he didn't know. I mean, that's how he explains it, even as I said. Okay. Now, they ask another question. Here the Gemara says, right, that Hebron is one of the cities. And yet, where do we find any indication that Hebron was to be one of the cities? Hebron near Miklothi? You say that Hebron is a city of refuge? The Oksiv, doesn't it say in the first chapter of the book of Judges, says, Vayitlu the Kolev, that they gave to Kolev, who happened to be the conqueror of Hebron, They gave him his Hebron, right? Kasher Dibber Moshe, even as Moshe Rabbeinu had said that it would be his, right? Kol Ben Yifuna, right. That this was the special gift that was given to him because he was, you know, loyal to Moshe Rabbeinu, right. And this was to be his reward. So, how can we say that Hebron then, you know, is an Ir Miklot when we say that this was given to to Kol Ben Yifuna? So Abaye came up with a very good answer. He says, Parvatva. He says, what they gave to Kolev actually was the suburbs. They gave him Longmeadow. Gave him the suburbs. That was to be his. But the city itself, that could serve as an Ir Miklot. This is how Abaye understands. The Tziv, he says, we find a pasuk that says, Joshua says, V'yesedei ha'ir, V'yeshatzireho, that the fields of the city, and as well as the open spaces around it, Nostan the Kolev Ben Yifuna. Right, they gave food to Kolev Ben Yifuna. Now, the next question, how about Kedesh? For Kedesh him Miklot Havai. Was Kedesh then also a city of refuge? Oksiv, doesn't it say, V'yorei Mivtzor, Hatzedim, Tzor, V'chamas, Rekas, V'kineres, V'kedesh, V'yadrei, V'yenchatzor. In other words, these were cities that were fortified. And then, you know, he gives a list of the various places, including Rekas, including
Kedesh,
right, okay? So, how can you square that? Betanya, and we also have Gemara, which says that Orem Halolo Einosin Asan, that those cities, you're not to make them low tier and ketanim, below krakim gedolim. You're not to make them into either small fortified areas or into great big metropolises. Ela yoros benonios. But rather, you are to make these six cities that we mentioned into average towns. This is how we have to translate it over here. Okay?
Buildings. Would it be known as buildings?
No. Beinoni means average.
Average.
Right. Beinoni. As the Gemara says, that there, you know, on Rosh Hashanah, you know, the Beinu Shalom takes a look in the books to see, you know, which were written. So you have, first of all, the book of Tzadikim Geburim, right? Then you have a book of Rishoyim Geburim, you know, those who are absent. And the rest of us, what are we? We're Beinonim. We're, you know, the average people, we're in between. Comes to the word Bain, of course, which means between. Yeah.
Oh, Bain between.
Right, so this is the derivation of the word. So Beinoni is average, right. Omar Rav Yosef, Tarte Kedesh Havai. So he gets out of the difficulty by saying, you know, there were two Kedeshes. Okay. Just as we said before, you know, that Kolev got the suburbs, the fields, the suburbs, and so on, but the city was so the same thing. There was a Kedesh which was an Ir Miklot, and another part of Kedesh which was not. Okay, that's what he's saying. Amar Rav Ashi. So Rav Ashi gives an example. He says, Kedon Selukum, the Akwa de Selukum. Actually, it should be Selukus probably, with a Samach rather than with a Mem. Okay? Because Seleucus, if you remember, he was the Syrian emperor who at one time had conquered Eretz Israel. Eretz Israel was part of his domain after the death of Alexander the Great. Yeah. And so naturally, there would be a city named after him, even in Eretz Israel.
Greater Syria? Would that be Greater Syria?
Yeah. But Seleucus was the name of the general, Alexander's general, who became then the head of the Seleucid dynasty.
Yes.
And, our friend Antiochus was a descendant of that dynasty. Except that what happened in between was that there was a war between Seleucus and Ptolemy, who was the emperor, the king of Egypt. And Eretz Israel first was in Egyptian hands, then it was in Syrian hands, and so on and so forth. All right. But anyway, that's not germane to what we're doing. It's just a little background, okay? But Seleucus, that's why I say it probably should have been with the Samach rather than the Mem over here. It's probably the name of a town, you know, which was named after the Syrian king, okay, the Greek king, whatever you want to call him. And so that city says there was Seleucus and there was Acra the Seleucus. Now, Acra is a Greek word. Acra means heights. You may have heard of, for example, acrophobia. Not agoraphobia, but acrophobia, which means that a person is afraid of heights, okay? Now, why was it called Acra? Well, this would be a high part overlooking the main town, okay? And it was a fortified area, okay? And this is how you have the Greek word for that part of Athens, which is called the Acropolis, which means literally the high part of the city, okay? So, he says Seleucus had it, so that therefore, if we're talking about Kedesh, so okay, so you had Kedesh proper, and then you had Upper Kedesh. The Akra, the you understand?
Yeah.
And that would be the answer, right? So that one part would be for, you know, the ordinary, let's say, Zanir Khalifa, and the other part would be the fortified area, which is not necessarily part of it, but only there to protect it, okay. At any rate, we'll see now that what I referred to just a little bit earlier, right? He says that these cities are to be Ayoras Benonius, in other words, average towns, not metropolises, right? And not, on the other hand, either, you know, little places, you know, just small fortified towns. The aim of Shivan Eson, he says, you know, not to settle these cities, you know, not to locate these cities, Elo b'mekom mayim, except in a place where water is abundant. The yemein sham mayim, and let's say if the area does not have water, then in that case, mevi'im lehem mayim. You have to bring water to them. The aim of Shivan Eson b'mekom shivokim. Also, you're not to locate them except in a place, you know, where there are going to be markets. V'ein moshiyin osan ele b'mekom uchlusin, and you're not to locate them except in a place where there is a population. And what would happen is ma'otu uchlusin, let's say that the population grew smaller. So in that case, moshiyin alehin, then you have to add population to them. They will always maintain, so to speak, you know, a stable population. Nisma'otu the urehin, and what if the people who were living in the place over there became smaller, so Mavilahem, then you have to bring them to people who will settle the place. And who do you bring them? You bring them Kahanim, Levim, Yisraelim. You have to bring all kinds of, in other words, you have to make these towns habitable places big enough to protect the Goel Hadon, not too big so that everybody would be able to know who's there, so that a Goel Hadam would not slip in unawares. If you have a big city like New York, you know. Exactly. So it has to be set up like that, and it has to be a place where there, you know, you can buy things, you can find a living over there.